You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 25th of March. And on the show today, the news that Britain's Princess Catherine has cancer has ricocheted around the world. We got the latest on her unprecedented video statement and the rumours she was likely trying to scotch with our UK royal correspondent Louise Beale. We also found out more about the cancer rates in young people and how you can catch it early. That was with oncologist Dr. Deborah Mukherjee from the Clemenceau Medical Centre in Dubai. Meanwhile, have you ever noticed that your sense of time is slightly warped around the period of the pandemic? Well, you're not alone. We spoke to Dr. Ruth Ogden, who's a professor of the psychology of time at the UK's Liverpool John Moores University. She's been researching how the COVID era impacted on how we value and feel about time. Meanwhile, tourism in the UAE is getting a boost thanks to couples choosing Dubai for their destination weddings. Ceremonies have soared threefold in the past 2 years, and the trends, they are changing. We got the lowdown with two wedding planners, Tasneem Alibai and Mark Khawaja. Meanwhile, Russia has charged four men, it says attacked a Moscow concert hall and killed at least 137 people. We have the very latest with Serena Kelly from the ARN News Centre. And as we're expecting some rain over the next couple of days, commuters travelling through Al Gubaibah metro station will be feeling very lucky indeed, because they'll be able to rent umbrellas. They're not normally designed for precipitation. Khaled Al-Wadi from the Roads and Transport Authority talked us through the initiative. Welcome back to The Agenda. Now, the news that Britain's Princess Catherine has cancer has ricocheted around the world. It literally made headlines in countries far, far away from the United Kingdom. I saw it come through on Friday night, and I wanted to get a sense of how global a story this was before we sort of covered it on The Agenda, because obviously I'm a Brit and it's a particular interest to me, but I wanted to sort of make sure that it was resonating in the same way with other people. And I think it's fair to say that on Saturday it was the top news headline in pretty much every single country around the world. Now, the 42-year-old future Queen of England made the announcement in what was a really unprecedented style of television statement on Friday evening UAE time.
In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment.
Now, the poignant video, and if you haven't seen it, she's sitting at a bench with lots of daffodils behind her. And daffodils are very much a symbol of Marie Curie, which I think is sort of a cancer awareness organisation. So I don't think there was any coincidence in that. So there was a lot of visual messaging going on as well. But the video ended literally what's been weeks of really fervent sort of speculation about her whereabouts. She hasn't attended any official events since Christmas. And we've had just the most crazy, outlandish rumours of every sort. I'm probably not going to do the dignity of them, of describing them on the radio. I think potentially I could get into trouble, but for some of them, you know, I think many of them could be described as libelous. And this was all exacerbated when Princess Catherine released a photograph of her and her children on Mother's Day, and it was found that it had been edited, and that led to a whole nother frenzy on social media. But needless to say, now the tone of the commentators, both official and amateur, has completely changed. Joining me now to tell us a little bit more about how this message has been received in the United Kingdom is Louise Beale, who is our UK royal correspondent. Louise, thank you so much for joining us on the line. Tell me what it is that we actually know now about Princess Catherine's health.
Well, Georgia, thanks for having me. Well, what we do know is that things are perhaps a lot more serious than perhaps we were first led to believe. And I say led to believe, but actually it seems that the Prince and Princess of Wales themselves found her cancer diagnosis a total shock. She said herself in her statement that it had come a total shock to her. But what we did know was that in January, as you said, after Christmas, she stopped official duties and she was having abdominal surgery. And we weren't given any more detail apart from that. And that we found from this statement that she gave that cancer was found and that she is now starting chemotherapy, preventative chemotherapy, we're told, to be able to get her well again. She said in this statement that she is well and that she is getting stronger every day. But as you've alluded to, this statement, in many ways, it's felt was not only to update people on her health, because obviously she's a very senior member of the royal family, but also to try to stop some of the frankly quite ridiculous rumours that had begun to circulate about her health and about even her whereabouts, because people were speculating as to why she hadn't been seen, when she was coming back, and if she was actually okay. But we now know that something, you know, very serious had happened. And for a woman of her age with three very young children, I think, you know, any of us can put ourselves in her shoes and think how scary it must be for her and what a huge thing it's been for her and her family. And she said herself in a statement that it's been a very difficult couple of months, added to the fact that the king has cancer as well. It's been a really difficult time for the family.
It is such an unexpected development. And I think it's partly because she is such a young woman. She's only 42. She was expected to return to duties in after Easter. So sort of this is in about 2 weeks' time. But that has all changed now, of course.
Absolutely. And she is a young woman. And as you say, you know, even if you don't follow the royal family or are not particularly interested, I don't think anyone can fail to see, you know, the shock in this, that a young woman with young children has found cancer. You know, that's difficult. So, yes, we were expecting her to return at Easter. That was always the line, that she would be back after her surgery. But now there isn't any specific date as to when she's going to return, as you might expect. And this statement that she made was very personal, and she definitely referred to the people who've been very supportive. It was also a statement that was clearly saying, you know, stop now, let us heal in peace, and please respect our privacy to be able to deal with this very difficult thing in private without so much speculation. So we now don't know when she will return, and many would argue, nor should we need to know. It will obviously be when she is better. It is thought that the king, who, as I said, is undergoing treatment for cancer himself, will be making an appearance at Easter, probably for the usual family service, or that is the hope. And certainly what I'm being told is that plans are very much in motion for the king to be back at work. And we are told that privately, he's very keen to do so. He's frustrated that he hasn't been able to carry out his duties, and he is very keen to get back to work. So from that very senior team of the British royal family, you know, two key members have been seriously unwell, and it's hoped that at least one of them is able to return soon. When the Princess of Wales will return, we don't know.
There was some quite careful timing to this release of a video statement, wasn't there? Because it was actually recorded on Wednesday. We hear that it was planned 2 weeks in advance. What's the link there to why you think it was released on Friday afternoon in the United Kingdom specifically?
Well, we are led to believe it is because that is when Prince's George and Louis and Princess Charlotte finished school for their Easter holidays. So there is the thought that they wanted to make the announcement then, when they could then bring the children home for the Easter holidays and not have to allow them any further exposure to any scrutiny that was probably happening amongst people that they were seeing. So I think they very much are hunkering down for this Easter break and trying to deal with what's happening as a family, because these are very young children, and to know, you know, to hear the word cancer must be quite frightening. And I suspect, I'm sure, they just want to be with their children, and as she said, to tell them in an appropriate way. But we are told that the Princess of Wales very much planned this statement herself. She wanted to do it. She didn't want to release a written statement. She wanted it to be a video so that she could talk to people. So the timing of it and how it's been executed have been very much down to her, at the timing that she wanted to do it and the way that she wanted to do it.
At the end of her statement, for people that haven't listened to it all the way through, it's only about a sort of 2-3 minute long statement. And at the end, she reaches out to other cancer sufferers and tells them not to be without hope, that they're not alone. It was quite, I mean, that was really poignant. I imagine that the impact of that final statement for people who are either going through cancer treatment at the moment or, you know, or have a family member going through it must have felt quite personal in many ways.
Yeah, really personal and, you know, very powerful. And we're told that the Princess of Wales does know the power and the influence that she has. And I think this was obviously her moment to be able to reach out to other people and to acknowledge the fact that she's not the only person obviously going through this disease or who is affected by this disease. And she very much wanted to use her position, we can only imagine, to be able to say something at that point. And perhaps there is some solidarity in that, to know that you're not alone when you're going through something very difficult. But as you say, it was a really personal, I think, statement and very powerful. It was clever to the point that I think it really will hopefully, and it does seem to have here in the UK, certainly made the media and social media and all that fervent speculation has just really calmed down. There have been plenty of very high profile people apologising for speculating on where she was. So I think they will hopefully be pleased that it has done what they wanted it to do, which is to inform people, but ask people for privacy, to get that privacy, but also to reassure people, as you're saying, that they are human, they know other people are going through this, and that they want to show some solidarity. Because, after all, the British royal family are, in many ways, there for the British people. That is part of their role. And so to be able to reach out in this way, in the way that the King has too, by revealing his cancer diagnosis, you know, this is quite a departure from when senior royals have been ill in the past. It was very much very private. You know, never complain, never explain. That was the motto of Queen Elizabeth II. But the King and the Princess of Wales have been far more open. And as a result, many would say appear much more human to people and really relatable.
Louise Beale there, our UK royal correspondent. Thank you very much indeed. And actually, we are going to continue that conversation over the next few minutes about the impact of that honesty on other people who might now go and get themselves checked out to see whether they might have cancer. We are going to discuss that next with a doctor, Dr. Deborah Mukherjee, who is a medical oncologist, because we want to find out how common cancer is in young people and what you can do to find out whether you might have it, you know, the checks you can get, the preventative measures that you can take. So all of that to come in the next few minutes. But yes, that was the voice of Louise Beale there, who's our UK royal correspondent, joining us right here on The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to The Agenda, and we are discussing on the programme now the shock news that Britain's Princess Catherine has cancer. The 42-year-old future queen made the announcement on Friday. It was a completely unprecedented television statement. People in the British royal family don't normally make these types of statements in this type of sort of way. And the news instantly made headlines in pretty much every single country around the world. Now, the details of the cancer haven't been disclosed, but her press team have said they are confident that the princess will make a full recovery. This is what she had to say about her health.
This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I've said to them, I am well and getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body and spirit. Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance too, as is the love, support and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both.
Now, Princess Catherine is only 42 years old. She says that this diagnosis, as you just heard, came as a complete surprise. So how common is cancer among young people and how can you prevent it? A little earlier, I spoke to Dr. Deborah Mukherjee. She's a medical oncologist right here in Dubai at the Clemenceau Medical Centre.
Of course, everyone is very shocked at the announcement. And I think the first thing to say is that anyone, no matter who they are, if they're in the public eye, has an absolute right to privacy in terms of their medical diagnosis. So we certainly don't want to speculate about specific cases, but talking in general and cancer diagnosis in women at a younger age, of course, it is less common than in older women and men because the rate of cancer does increase as people get older. But we are seeing an increase in cancers in younger women, particularly breast cancers. We see an increasing rate of colon and rectal cancers in younger people worldwide. And we're not quite sure about the reasons for this. There may be some reasons to do with environmental, lifestyle, and genetic causes. We certainly do have a high rate of breast cancer in young women in the Middle East compared to Europe and North America. And we're still working out why that is.
Princess Catherine has suggested or said that she was getting preventative chemotherapy, or she was undertaking a course of preventative chemotherapy. Is that quite normal as a treatment?
Absolutely. And this is something which I think there has been some questions about from the public. And we always welcome a discussion about cancer early diagnosis and preventative treatment and cancer prevention in general. So when we talk about preventative chemotherapy, this is usually given after a cancer has been removed from a part of the body, and it's always diagnosed finally under the microscope. And that's sometimes why it takes a while to get that proper diagnosis of a cancer, what it is and what stage it is. And then depending on what we're dealing with, occasionally we will be recommending preventative or adjuvant chemotherapy, which means giving chemotherapy after a cancer has been removed from the body to destroy and eliminate any tiny remaining cancer cells that might be in the circulation that can't be detected on a blood test or on a scan. So this is really what we describe as our insurance policy. This is making sure that we've done everything we can to eliminate all cancer cells from the body and maximize the chance of cure.
And would that course of preventative chemotherapy last for just a few months, or can it potentially be a sort of ongoing medication?
So this really depends on the specific case, and usually preventative chemotherapy lasts for a few months of treatment. We have various protocols for different types of disease and different stages of disease. Sometimes we use additional treatments as preventative strategies, particularly for breast or prostate cancer in men. We're talking about hormonal therapies that can be given as a preventative treatment. And these types of therapies may be given for several years. In terms of chemotherapy, which is what people normally think of, the intravenous or into the vein chemotherapy, this is usually a course of several months, but it very much depends on the case in question.
Now, one of the reasons why Princess Catherine has said that she is well and she is going to get better is because, of course, this cancer was caught very early indeed. And I think that this has probably brought cancer to the front of many people's minds long before maybe we might have considered it. I mean, I am 45. It came as a huge shock for me to hear that a woman, you know, with three children who is younger than me could already have cancer. And your immediate response is, well, what can I do to make sure I catch any cancer early as well? So what type of checks can people go through?
This is a great question, and this is why it's such a brave thing for anyone in the public eye to go public with their cancer diagnosis. It really does start that conversation about what everyone can do to reduce their risk of cancer or detect it early. So for young women, certainly from the age of 40, we should all be recommending mammograms and ultrasounds for breast cancer screening. If anyone has a family history, we might need to do earlier scanning. So knowing your family history of cancer is very important. Also being breast aware. So we do unfortunately diagnose cancers in the breast in women under 40, and often they present with a lump in the breast, which gets checked out and unfortunately in rare cases can turn out to be a cancer. But when we catch these things early, it means that we have a much higher chance of curing them. So everyone should be breast aware and make sure that any unusual changes are checked out immediately. In women, we also do the pap smear test and HPV testing these days for cervical cancer. This is usually done from the age of the early 20s with a gynecologist every 1 to 2 years. And we're now recommending HPV vaccination, that's vaccination against the virus that can cause cervical cancer, for boys and girls in their pre-teenage years. And we can actually extend that to anyone usually under the age of 27 can benefit from an HPV vaccination. So these are things that we can do to prevent cancer as well. For other types of cancer, again, colon cancer is usually found in older people. And the recommendations are now from the age of 45 for men and women to undergo a colonoscopy test, which can detect polyps and remove them before they have a chance to become cancers. The other side of cancer prevention is reducing risks. So not smoking, having a healthy diet, staying active, staying a healthy weight, reducing exposure to things like cigarette smoke and too much UV light with sun tanning and sunburning. These are all things that we can all do to reduce the cancer risk for ourselves and our communities.
Princess Catherine finished off her very sort of emotional statement by speaking to other cancer sufferers and saying, you're not alone. And there was this sort of sense of her being part of a community and wanting to support others who are going through it. Is there a lot of support here in the UAE for people going through cancer? Where can people find that type of support?
This is really important. And the support of initially friends and family, the medical team is vitally important. But here in the UAE, we do have several organizations which do offer both psychological and financial support to patients undergoing cancer treatment. Some examples of these in Dubai are the Friends of Cancer Patients that do a huge amount of fantastic work, both in cancer screening, support of patients with cancer. There are organizations such as Majlis Al-Amal, which also provide help groups, a lot of extra support. And there are various different supportive organizations dotted around the Emirates. And it's always important for everyone to, as I said, start these conversations, talk to their friends and family, make sure this is a subject which people can talk about openly, and so that we can improve our rates of early diagnosis and cancer cure.
Dr. Deborah Mukherjee there, medical oncologist at the Clemenceau Medical Centre in Dubai. And I'd love to hear from you off the back of that interview if you know of any community organisations that support people who are struggling with cancer. And I'd also be really interested to know whether the news of Princess Catherine's diagnosis had any impact on you at all. I have to admit, it did impact on me. And I don't think it's because I'm British. I'm not a particular massive fan of the royal family or anything like that. I don't follow them particularly closely, you know, their activities, all of that type of thing. I think it was just hearing that a woman younger than me could have cancer. And it has focused my mind. As Dr. Mukherjee just said, you know, over the age of 45, you should go for preventative colonoscopies. Now, that's something that I've known I should be doing. My mother and my grandmother both had and have fortunately recovered from bowel cancer. And honestly, I've been putting off a colonoscopy. Like, I don't really want to go through it. You know, it's a bit uncomfortable, tiny bit of risk, I suppose. But more, I just don't want to go through it. And I should. And I think hearing about this diagnosis, it focuses the mind, doesn't it? Ultimately, it focuses the mind. It makes you grow up a bit. And it makes you realize that, you know, if we have these opportunities to prevent early stage, you know, late stage cancer by going to get checked, then we really ought to go. And so I'm probably going to book that colonoscopy. I'm probably going to go through with it. I already have the mammograms. Please go for your mammograms. They don't hurt. It's a very good thing to do. Public service announcement there. But yes, I think, and I don't think I can be the only one who sort of stopped and taken stock and, you know, thought, right, it's time for me to, you know, act as well. And I'd love to hear from you if you're one of those people as well. Or not. Like, if you just think the story is completely irrelevant and, you know, it hasn't really impacted you on you at all, then I'd also like to hear from you.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's #1 talk radio station.
Welcome back to the show. Right, if you look back a few years ago, do you find your sense of time is slightly warped around 2020? It definitely is for me. I seem to find friends who've got toddlers and I just I've never met their baby as a baby. Like, it's really weird. I don't remember them as babies. And that's because they were born right at the start of the pandemic or in the middle of the pandemic. Or they'll just be a complete blip in my memory. I just won't remember a certain event. Well, if that is happening to you too, you are not alone, according to my new guest. Ruth Ogden is a professor of the psychology of time at the UK's Liverpool John Moores University. And she has been researching how the COVID era has impacted basically on how we feel about time and how we value time. And she joins me now on the line. Dr. Ogden, thank you so much for coming on the agenda. So did the pandemic actually have a universal impact on our perception of time?
That's such a good question. So we did research during the first lockdown and the second lockdown in the UK to try and understand what these fundamental changes in society were doing to our experience of time. And what we found was that about 80% of the population felt like time was really different during the pandemic to normal, but it was really split in terms of how they experienced it. So about half of people felt like the pandemic just flew by really quickly. The days were really fast. And about half of people felt like the days were really slow. It dragged. The pandemic was super long. And what we tended to find was that the people who had a fast pandemic were coping. So they were well socially connected. They were busy, but they weren't too stressed. They weren't depressed. Whereas the people who had these really long, slow, drawn out pandemics, these are the people who were socially isolated, they were depressed, they were stressed, they were anxious. So coping is really important to how we experience the length of something like a pandemic.
Were there any other things at play? I have to say, I was going to say, I didn't want to interrupt you, but when you said for some people it really dragged, I was like, I bet that was the parents who were meant to cope, you know, to homeschool their children.
Most definitely. I mean, the reason that I did this research was because I was on maternity leave during the pandemic and I couldn't believe that there are only 24 hours in the day. And I think what happened during the pandemic was, particularly for parents, is that we lost all of the structure in our day. So there was no school, there was no after school club, there was no holiday camp, there was nothing to keep our children entertained. All of a sudden we were school and we were everything else. And the load of that and the stress of that made the pandemic really slow and really difficult for lots and lots of parents around the world.
I'm interested to know, you know, outside pandemics, because hopefully they're rare and, you know, only happen once every century or so. What kind of other events have an impact on our perception of time?
It's a great question. So one of the things that any of your listeners who've been in a near-death experience will have had is that sensation of time slowing down right before you think you might die. So we see it in terrorist attack accounts, in car crashes. So our state of emotion is really fundamental to our experience of time. If we are really, really aroused, if we feel like we're under really significant threat, then our sense of time slows down. And we think that this is to give us some sort of survival advantage. So if we see things in slow motion, if we feel things in slow motion, then maybe we have more time to think about how to respond.
Do you think there's any way of actively controlling it, or do you think it's always going to be at a subconscious level?
So I would like to think that in the future we'll all be able to control our sense of time, so that the time in the dentist chair is super short and the time on the beach is super long. I think we're a way away from that now, but what we can do is try and put strategies in place to make our sense of time more within our control. So audit your time, figure out where you're using your time, where you're using it well, and prioritize the things that make you happy. Try and stay relaxed in periods which are stressful, to try and keep your arousal down so that you feel like you've got more control over time. But I think in modern day society, one of the things that we all struggle with is time pressure. Time gets away from us. And learning to say no to things is critical to regaining your control over your sense of time.
Do you know, I remember a colleague telling me years ago that the way to make your life feel longer is to just do something different every day. So don't do exactly the same commute every day. Don't go exactly the same way. Try and do, you know, a little twist on something, and that will make your life feel longer. Do you think that's good advice as a professor of time?
I think that's excellent advice. So one of the things that I advise people when they ask me how to feel like they've got a longer life or had more time is to get rid of a to-do list and have an I did list instead. So our brain judges time by looking at how many new memories we formed. If we can keep our brain active, if we can remind ourselves of all the wonderful things that we do every day and all the new things that we learn, then we'll look back on our lives and it'll feel longer. So I think that's an absolutely great tip.
Brilliant. Well, there we go. I will roll with that for the rest of the day. Well, the rest of the year, hopefully. Let's see which feels longest. Dr. Ruth Ogden there, Professor of the Psychology of Time at the UK's Liverpool John Moores University. Thank you so much for your time.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Now, as we all know, tourist numbers in Dubai are continuing to break records. You've got more flights coming into the country than ever before. And to all intents and purposes, we are back to those pre-COVID levels. But one sort of key economic driver that we don't necessarily talk about a great deal in Dubai is the fact that the city-state is a rather fantastic destination wedding venue. It's a beautiful night. Yes, any excuse for some Bruno Mars. But new figures are showing that weddings here have increased threefold in the past 2 years. Now, that is thanks to the Department of Economy and Tourism. They'd released their latest figures, and they say that these numbers are now surpassing the pre-COVID stats of 2019. But what's interesting is that the style of weddings is changing. Many couples are now actually choosing more intimate and more personalised destination weddings with just, get this, 50 to 100 guests. Now, for me, that's quite a big wedding, which gives you a sort of sense of how large they can get. And also, apparently, couples are getting more tech-friendly with their events, using artificial intelligence and even virtual reality. Now, that bit confuses me because I can't think of a way in which you'd use either of those two things in your wedding ceremony. But fortunately, we are going to find out more. And I'm joined now in the studio by wedding planner to the stars, Tasneem Alibai. Now, she runs her own eponymous weddings and special occasions company. You might recognize her voice. If you watch on TV, you might recognize her face because she has been on Dubai Bling, because she organised both Caroline Stanbury's wedding and, of course, our friend from one of the studios just down the corridor, Chris Fade, as well. And she joins me in our studio now. Tasneem, thanks so much for coming in. Lovely to have you with us.
Good morning. Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you here because you are going to tell us all about whether or not, the realities behind these rather interesting numbers. Have you noticed a big growth in your own business?
Yes, we have. So basically, after COVID, the way Dubai has opened up, we are getting more and more inquiries for destination weddings here in Dubai. As you said, the numbers are going smaller, but it's getting more grander.
So less guests, yeah. But more panache.
100%. Yeah.
That is very interesting to hear. What kind of... I suppose what I want to know what nationalities the people are who are coming to celebrate their weddings here. Who are the most popular?
Well, we have a lot of Indian weddings here, which is over 2-3 days. But also we've seen increased in Western weddings as well. We have clients from UK, we have clients from US, Canada. And it's not only ceremony followed by a reception, but it's also added like one or two more events, like a brunch or a welcome party or an after party has been added on as well. So people are more after experiences. It might be lesser decor, but more experiences, more memories, and just being with a close family and friends. Yeah,
I want to talk about money. I want to talk about budget because I can only, you know, you are at the very top end of this, these sort of arrangements. What type of money are people spending?
People are spending.
They are spending,
are, but they're spending cleverly.
Oh, okay.
So, as I said, they're putting the money into memories. Then, just like photos and videos are important, in social media is important. So they have the best landmarks, the best backdrops. You know, when they come to Dubai, they have a choice of beaches. They have a choice of, you know, these beautiful buildings. So they are spending money on that. But we're talking about, you know, anything between 50 to 100 people, anything starting from 80,000, 90,000 going all the way to 1 million.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That is amazing. Yeah. That, I mean, that, and when you say, you know, it's a sort of more intimate wedding with just 50 to 100 guests, yeah. Is that because your big Indian wedding, you're talking literally hundreds of people?
See, with Indian weddings, it's always been a large number. So that's still there, 250 to 300. But when it comes to Western weddings, we've seen like 70 and 100 people.
Okay, so what are the trends? Because I remember, I have to admit, that there was a time when, you know, about in the year before I got married, when I became totally obsessed with wedding planning, to the extent I actually started my own wedding website. and such was my devotion to this that I ended up actually making a decent amount of money out of it. Like, it became a real thing for me. I was posting 3 or 4 times a day, all the sort of ideas. My wedding was themed around a secret garden. It was
amazing.
I had a key motif added to every single little tiny detail. And I did lots of the sort of crafting and things like that myself to save money. So I got very into wedding trends then. And, you know, there was even lots of talk about different coloured wedding dresses, even ombre wedding dresses that change shade as they approach the floor. So what are the sort of trends at the moment?
So brighter colours, for sure, a sharper colour palette. The greens and the whites are kind of going out. People are being more daring. The couples are showing more of their personality in the weddings. Cakes are out. They'd rather put it into takeaway boxes so people can take it with them. Digital welcome messages, like thank you messages, like you have stuff like videos. Instead of having a guest book, people are doing voice messages so a couple can keep that forever. They're doing extravagant photo backdrops for the photos to be there. They're doing Polaroid pictures with albums where guests can stick the message and the pictures. More personalized items are coming in, and lesser bridesmaids, lesser groomsmen. Bridesmen and groomsmen don't need to be in the same colors anymore. You know, it doesn't need to be uniformed. You know, it's more about, you know, enhance your personality and show it in the wedding. So, yeah.
So how are people getting, you mentioned there a sort of element of how things are getting more tech friendly. How are you using artificial intelligence or virtual reality in weddings? I'm really intrigued by that element to this story.
See, there is a mixed review on AI. Like, some people like it, some people are totally against it, some people like it. Me personally, if you ask me, I think it's okay. As long as you're not claiming that that work is yours, as in you've done it in real life, but it's a perfect way of showing the couple how the venue can look.
That's what you use it for.
Yeah, that's what we use it for. More like designing, like showing them this is how it's going to look. Because with AI, you know, the imagination can go crazy. You can have one of the most amazing picture and the couple can actually visualize how it's going to look. I think AI is the future for sure. And
Okay, so I can't. I'm really interested also as to whether Dubai is proving more popular than Abu Dhabi, because I know the legal framework is different in Abu Dhabi. You can actually get married legally in Abu Dhabi.
Still, you can, but there are still rules. It's easier, yes. But I think people are choosing Dubai because of the landmarks as well. So
it's just got more pizzazz, more recognition.
100%.
Okay, so I'm going to have to ask you this because I know that you work with some of the sort of richest people in the world, also some of the most famous people in the world. So you've bound to have dealt with some outlandish, unusual requests. I'm going to ask you to...
See, we don't have like... crazy. Well, we have had a request of a white tiger in a procession of a barat before, which we did.
I love you. It's like, we don't have crazy requests.
And elephants. We had crazy requests like that, but obviously due to the rules and regulation, we couldn't pull it off. But what I've seen is what couples are requesting is trends that celebrities are doing. So like with the Ambani wedding going on right now.
Oh, wow.
Not the wedding, the pre-wedding celebration.
I know.
Ambani,
I mean, who does
insane.
A pre-wedding wedding? I mean, that's just so bonkers.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But with that, the entrance song that she entered on, you know, every bride wants that song right now. What they wear, the jewellery they're wearing, the way they've even put the scarf on their head, the colour palette. So all that, it's very influenced by what the celebrities are wearing. And because it goes viral on Instagram and on social media as well. So that's being used.
You must have been completely glued to that Ambani pre-wedding wedding.
I was. I couldn't get my eyes off her jewellery.
Amazing, wasn't it?
Amazing.
And her mother's massive green emerald necklace.
I think every woman wants that.
I mean, literally, it's sort of all I can think of. Like, all you can think about.
And her ring.
And the ring. I mean, goodness me. I say, so going forward, what would you expect to see in the trends going forward? You know, what is your, I suppose, what are you forecasting for the weddings of 2024-5?
See, a lot of destination weddings are coming up. Like, yeah. Most of my clients are from abroad who are coming into Dubai. So definitely destination weddings. Italy is very popular. South of France is really popular. We have 3 destination weddings just coming up now in summer. So I would say intimate, smaller weddings with close family and friends. And a lot more fun than spending money on experiences than spending money on decor. So,
to give you a sense of how bridezilla I went, at one stage, I decided that I wanted synchronized swimmers in the swimming pool at the venue of where I got married. I'd like to inform you that synchronized swimmers are a lot more expensive, I think, maybe than even a white tiger.
Yeah.
They wanted 10,000 euros for a 3-minute performance.
Well, entertainment, we get entertainment from all over the world. So I completely understand that. You know, people are, as I said, they want to enhance their experience. So entertainment is a big part of a wedding. So,
but maybe not synchronized.
But maybe not that.
Well, that's a new idea. It's a new idea. Who knows? Yeah. Absolutely fantastic to speak to you, Tasneem. Thank you so much
for
your
me.
Time. Lovely to
Thank
have you,
you
in the studio to get those sort of insights. Tasneem Alibai runs her own eponymous weddings and special occasions company. It's called Tasneem Alibai Weddings and Special Occasions, so you know how to find it. And of course, she has worked with some of our local celebrities, you know, like Chris Fade and Caroline Stanbury as well, which is absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been lovely to have you here
on the agenda. And I wish your business well. It's great news that Dubai is proving just so popular for
Thank
destination
you
weddings. Right, as we all know, tourist numbers in Dubai continue to break records. They are basically back to normal now from that sort of pre-2019 figures where they just sort of increased exponentially. Then we had the sort of COVID situation when everything stopped, but now we seem to be finally back to normal. So we talk about that quite a bit here on the agenda. But one driver that we actually haven't touched on for quite a while now is the fact that Dubai is increasingly popular as a destination wedding venue. Love a bit of Bruno Mars. Yep, new figures show that weddings here have increased threefold in the past 2 years. That is according to official figures from the Department of Economy and Tourism. They say that they have now surpassed the pre-COVID numbers of 2019. But apparently the style of the weddings is changing. People are now doing more intimate weddings, apparently, with just 50 to 100 guests. When I read this, I was a bit like, that's quite a lot, actually. But it turns out it's not. It's considered quite an intimate wedding. And apparently couples are also getting a lot more tech friendly with their ceremonies. And organisers or planners are using artificial intelligence and even virtual reality. And I can't quite visualise that. So fortunately, I am joined now on the line by wedding planner to the stars, or just also ordinary people, Mark Kowaja, who is co-founder of Le Table Events. They organise all sorts of events, but obviously weddings as well. Mark, it's lovely to have you join us on the line. Have you noticed a growth in the number of weddings? Are you getting more popular, for example?
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me on again. Always a pleasure. And yes, big time. Ever since COVID, it's been surging. Let's just say that the UAE really played its cards right, and it's just been wonderful. honestly.
So what's, because I know that Abu Dhabi has changed the law and now it's much easier to have a civil wedding there. Has that made Abu Dhabi more popular than Dubai, or is Dubai still winning?
You know, the thing that I love about the UAE is that each emirate has something for everybody. Dubai has the more woomph factor in it, whereas Abu Dhabi has this more tranquil serenity to it. So it's got this calmness vibe, and some people want something a little bit more in tune with that. So other emirates have something different to offer. So both are extremely popular. And yes, Abu Dhabi has risen a lot in popularity because simply people are starting to notice Abu Dhabi and its incredible potential. Emirates Palace, for example, one of the most popular venues here, the St. Regis, the Saadiyat and its stunning beaches, or venues that have the lovely views of the gorgeous mosque, for example. So, yeah, there's something for everybody in this country.
I'm really interested to hear that, but I want you to put some numbers on it. So have you seen, for example, you know, a doubling or a tripling even in the number of people wanting to get married here? And what are people spending? Has that changed?
Well, I mean, one of the good things when talking about numbers is that we've personally seen as La Table an increase in 4 times the amount of inquiries since 2002. And a lot of people even changing incredibly popular destinations from across the world, and specifically picking the UAE because they feel that amongst everything, there is a factor of safety, which is very important, especially for the more high-end or ultra-high-end clients. They want to come in and feel very safe. For example, Lebanon, as a good example, was always a very popular destination for weddings, but less and less people are feeling safe doing their weddings there, and they are changing and moving to do their weddings in the UAE so that they can feel that. It's not just always about beauty. There's a very big safety element to this country that it has to offer.
That's really interesting. No one's sort of mentioned that before. But of course, if you're going to spend literally thousands of dirhams or dollars or whatever your currency might be, the last thing you would want is for it to be ruined because of, you know, because somebody got something stolen, frankly. I remember when I got married, the Icelandic volcano eruption nearly ruined my wedding because no one could fly. If the ash had kept on coming out for another 4 or 5 hours, I think my wedding would have had to be cancelled. And believe me, I put my life into planning my wedding. I got very, very obsessed with it. Tell me, what are the trends as far as, you know, how things are looking? You know, have you seen that people are doing these slightly more intimate and personal weddings? What's the trends?
I love this question as much as I don't like this question, because what really trends is something that trends for everybody. But the truth is that intimacy is the real thing that is starting to trend. So less and less parents getting involved in planning the weddings, because parents tend to make things a little bit more political. They think about who they're inviting, while as the people that are actually getting married care a lot more about who's around them. So they want things to be more private. They want to be with their close friends. They want to remember this as the most magical, beautiful day of their life. And also they can get to focus their budget more on the actual experience, the decor, the intricate details that are endless in weddings, and less on having to spend more on just having a larger number of guests. And we, in fact, support this trend big time because, I mean, I'm of a millennial generation, and I can imagine that I would much rather have a wedding of 50 to 100 people, of people that I care about and I get to splurge on them, than having a 500 people wedding where most of the people are just there to gossip.
I mean, my goodness me, that is exactly how it feels sometimes, let's be honest. You know, they just want to look at you and see, oh, how much did she spend on that dress? Tell me about you say that, of course, you're from that sort of new generation, that younger generation. What is it, you know, how is tech being sort of wrapped into the wedding ceremony, for example? I honestly, it was in the newspaper, it said that people were using AI in their wedding, and I literally could not imagine how.
Okay, if I can have a couple of minutes to talk about this. Let's talk about AI-generated weddings, which has become very popular these days for people sending them to me as their mood boards, where I have to go out and point to them. this is AI generated, it is undoable, or it is incredibly unfeasible to do. So AI is a very beautiful tool. It can help you develop mood boards. It can help you find a way to match a lemon Portuguese theme in your most arabesque ballroom. However, it needs to be used responsibly, especially by organizers. So I would never showcase a wedding to a client with a preset expectation that this is the wedding that would be delivered using AI, but I may use AI to help me generate a sort of mood board template, but then create an actual deliverable expectation accordingly. I'm not sure if I sounded confusing or I made sense, but this is because more and more you're seeing AI-developed weddings going viral on social media, and many people are not being able to identify them as AI-generated. So it's a big positive factor, but it can be a very dangerous one as well if we're not careful to catch it.
That's so interesting. So rather than, you know, when I was getting married, you might look on a blog or flick through a magazine, but now you can get sort of totally fake AI-generated images of weddings, and people are being inspired by that and asking for it, and it's not manageable.
The inspiration is not really what worries me. In fact, I can get inspired by them, but it is the expectation. And I've seen some of these weddings where they're in the middle of water or on lily pads or a wedding apparently that was done in Petra, where I know that you can't have a wedding being done right over there, but that was an AI-generated wedding also recently gone viral. It is extremely concerning because it sets a false expectation. In fact, there was a case before, a couple of weeks ago, where an event was being sold to people so that they could buy tickets that was completely AI generated. And then when people actually came into the event, it was terribly done. So it was a massive scam. And then the problem is that one bad apple will ruin it for 100 good apples. So this is where I just would beg people to be a little bit cautious and conscientious that a lot of the weddings are being developed by AI. If they look too airbrushed, they are AI.
That's so interesting, because that's going to, if it's happening in events and it's happening in weddings, then it's only a matter of time before it happens, you know, on holiday, you know, with holidays, people creating fake sort of holiday images and raising expectations. In fact, let's be honest, it's probably happening already. Mark Khawaja, thank you so much for your time. Lovely to have you join us on The Agenda. Mark is the co-founder of Le Table Events, who organise weddings, joining us here on The Agenda to talk through that extraordinary exponential growth in destination weddings. They have increased threefold in the last 2 years.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Right, I'm delighted to say that I've been joined in the studio by ARN's Serena Kelly, of course, the voice of news for the nation. And the reason why Serena's joined me in the studio is because we have a developing story in Russia. Now, I'm sure everyone who has any sense of the news agenda will know that there was an attack on Friday night. 137 people died in that shooting and explosion in a theatre. And a national day of mourning was declared yesterday in Russia. Now, there has been some movement on the story this morning because four men who were accused of carrying out that terror attack have appeared in court. When you see pictures of them, they had bruising, they had swollen faces, and some had black eyes. And that is symptomatic of the Russian media broadcast footage over the weekend of violent interrogations. So obviously you could see the impact of that. Now, Serena Kelly has been following this story in detail and joins us now with the latest. Serena, what can you tell us about what happened in Moscow over the weekend?
Well, so far, the UAE has strongly condemned that recent attack in Moscow in Russia. As you were discussing, Georgia, there happened on Friday. It was a concert hall. 137 people were killed, 182 injured. Footage shows gunmen dressed in camo opening fire with automatic weapons. The video showed people taking their seats, then rushing for the exits. This woman, Margarita Bonova, managed to escape from the venue on Friday.
All that happened stays in my eyes, in my ears. This is pain. It was 7:47 p.m. I heard a blast. I honestly thought it was a firecracker. I thought probably the artists who came here were being greeted by fans, but these crackles, they weren't stopping. There was screaming, panic.
So investigators said that some died from gunshot wounds, and as you mentioned before, Georgia, others died from that huge fire that broke out in the complex. A report saying the gunman lit the blaze using petrol from canisters that they had in rucksacks. This man, Sergei, survived the attack.
There was panic. Everyone was running here and there. We realised that there would be no hostage taking. We had to do something, run away, because somebody was coming to kill us all.
Serena, do we have any sense of why this attack was carried out, who these four men are?
Well, ISIS has claimed responsibility, but the Russian president thinks Ukraine played a part. Here is Vladimir Putin. He was saying the attackers tried to flee to Ukraine.
All those who shot and killed people were found and detained. They tried to hide and were moving towards Ukraine, where, according to preliminary data, a passage was prepared for them on the Ukrainian side to cross the state border.
Now, Ukraine have denied the accusations. You've also had US National Security Council spokesperson Adrian Watson saying there was no Ukrainian involvement whatsoever. Here is President Volodymyr Zelensky. He denied his country was involved, saying it's completely predictable for Russia to accuse Ukraine.
What happened yesterday in Moscow, it's obvious that both Putin and others are trying to shift responsibility on someone else. They always have the same methods. It has already happened. They've already been blowing up houses, shootings and explosions, and they always blame others.
So far today, the accusations have continued to be exchanged on either side from the Russians and the Ukrainians. But in the meantime, France has raised its terror levels. Needless to say, Serena, this is a key story for the ARN News Centre. You will be keeping across it, won't
Definitely.
You?
Definitely. So stay tuned, obviously, to the agenda and the news bulletins throughout the day. We'll be giving you updates as the story develops.
Serena Kelly, thank you very much indeed.
This is The Agenda.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Welcome back to The Agenda. Lovely to have you with us. Right, it's time for us to turn our attention to a top local story that is making headlines this week. And if you look out the window, you couldn't help but notice that it's a little bit unsettled weather-wise. There's not very good visibility at the moment, quite a lot of dust in the air. And according to the National Centre of Meteorology, we are forecast a couple of days of rain today and tomorrow. I personally am looking forward to it. Nothing like a bit of wet weather to keep the heat down. And commuters who are travelling through Al Gubeiba bus and metro station won't need to worry if the heavens open, because they can always borrow an umbrella. That is thanks to a new free smart umbrella service that is being launched by the Roads and Transport Authority. Now, their initiative is in collaboration with Umbra City. They are a leading Canadian smart umbrella share service company, who I imagine do exactly what they say on the tin. Earlier, I spoke to Khaled Alawadi. He's director of the transportation systems at Dubai's Roads and Transport Authority. And he told me the thinking behind this new plan.
This goes back to Dubai 2040 plan, which encourages people actually to commute by walking, by cycling. It's part also of the city initiative, the 20-minute city, which means that people, they can reach to their main services in the city by, again, walking or cycling in 20 minutes. So RTA actually is working on a number of initiatives, as you can see, in terms of enhancing the walkability around the city and also creating the walking paths, cycling paths, and all these things. Now, one of the definitely important element over here also is to provide innovative services around such an experience. So the services that will enhance people's experience while they're walking, while they're cycling. So this partnership, which we have done with Umbra City, is aimed actually to provide one of these innovative services. So the idea is the following. RTA, actually, we have signed an agreement with Umbra City to provide a smart kiosk, which is like a vending machine where people, they can borrow an umbrella from location A to location B while they are commuting, walking, so they can shield themselves during the bad weather, like when we're having raining, or even during the harsh weather in summer, shielding themselves from the sun. And actually, this is again one of the initiatives to encourage the people in walking between a location to another location. And we have piloted this in currently in two locations, which is the Al Ghubeiba bus station all the way to Al Ghubeiba metro station.
So principally, these umbrellas are actually aimed to shade you from the sun, because, of course, we don't get very much rain here. How does it actually work? Can I be completely honest with you? I mean, the number of times I lost an umbrella on the London Tube when I was travelling, and the idea that I just wonder whether people are going to give them back. Can I be completely honest? How is it going to work?
Yeah, this is great. So first of all, we are providing this service for free, and this service definitely will be growing into other locations of the city. So the way that will be working, people, they can use either their credit card or their node card to borrow the umbrella just by simply tapping on the device that will allow them to take the umbrella with them, and they can use it for number of hours. Currently, we make it 24 hours, but later on, this will be shortened maybe to 3-4 hours. That will be enough time for people to actually use the umbrella, and then they return it back. So what would be encouraging people to return it back, since anyway they put their node card, in case of, for example, they kept the umbrella with them, they will be start charging after X number of hours. So this will also guarantee that the umbrella is returned back for other people later on to use it. So it will also ensure the continuity of the service and the quality of the service that we're looking to have.
Who do you think is most likely to use it? And are the umbrellas specially sort of designed to protect you from the sun?
It looks like a normal umbrella, just in a yellow color with the RTA tag on it. Big enough, yes, to protect it from the sun. But very convenient use, because just a normal umbrella, that it is provided through, let's say, a kiosk, and that can be tracked using a chip inside the umbrella. That's it. But the experience is very like using any normal umbrella.
Khaled Alawadi there, Director of Transportation Systems for Dubai's Roads and Transport Authority, just giving us a sense of that rather intriguing smart umbrella strategy that they are introducing at Al Ghubeiba bus and metro station. If you ever have used that service, please do get in touch. I would absolutely love to hear from you. I think it's one of those only in Dubai ideas. I just can't imagine it ever working anywhere else, because I think everyone would just steal the umbrellas or fail to give them back. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.